Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silk in Edinburgh, joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Thank you very much.
Did you have a good Easter?
I did well. Yes, I did. I did. I have learned that living even on the outskirts, where I live is kind of rural. I'm about 6 miles from Charlottesville, downtown Charlottesville. So I'm not exactly in the countryside, except there was a big storm on Saturday night that brought down a bunch of trees. I live in this mountaintop fortress and not unlike Monticello. And so I was stuck for much of the morning. My wife's actually back in Scotland at the moment. And so I was stuck for the morning, but I'm very grateful to Monticello security and the gardens and grounds teams who cleared these trees, which were quite substantial, blocking the driveway, which got me out in time for Easter lunch with some friends.
And so they had people on duty even on Easter Sunday morning. Okay, good.
I
That's
was a little bit worried when I called security because it was a Sunday morning and a holiday. But I said, could you come and take a look at this? And they did, and they did. So they've done a great job of looking after us this year.
Oh, well, that's wonderful to hear. All right, the reason why I bring up Easter, besides the fact that it was Easter, is that earlier on Holy Week, Donald Trump announced a new venture in his ongoing set of enterprises of things that are Trump branded, and that is he endorsed the God Save the USA Bible, which is available on GodSaveTheUSABible.com. If you're interested in acquiring a copy for yourself, it is $59.99 with gold deckled pages. It includes not only a leather bound Bible, large print, so it's easy to read if you need that. But it also includes not only the full text of the Bible, the text of Jesus in red, but also the handwritten chorus to Lee Greenwood's hit song, God Bless the USA, a copy of the US Constitution, a copy of the Bill of Rights. It doesn't say anything about the other amendments, but at least those first 10, a copy of the Declaration of Independence, and the Pledge of Allegiance. So you can get all this for the low price of $59.99. It is the King James Version of the Bible, for those of you who care about these things, which people surmise is because that's out of copyright. So they didn't have to pay any royalties for that. It was, I think, an interesting usage of the Bible. And so we thought we'd spend this episode talking about presidents and the Bible. But Frank, before we get to the 45 guys who have read or not read the Bible, as the case may be, what do you think about the Trump Bible?
I was, and I can't believe I'm going to say this after 8 years of this. I was a little surprised. I didn't think he had a capacity to surprise me anymore, but he did. I mean, he does seem to be quite desperate to raise money at the moment, in part because of his legal difficulties, but also in terms of the campaign. President Biden seems to be out raising him at the moment, raising more funds than he has. So this seems a little desperate. On the other hand, I've been reading a lot about this in the past couple of days in anticipation of this conversation. There's something going on here that's really, really interesting to me, at least, which is President Trump, former President Trump, is really, really kind of emphasizing and doubling down on his relationship with his evangelical base. And so while this Bible seemed both a little bit tacky, if I might say so, sort of selling Bibles for $60 is, it seems a little tacky. It's sending a political message to some of his supporters, to signal that he's with you. And there was a feature in the New York Times yesterday that was really breaking down the way that Trump's rallies have changed this time around, where he's been really leaning into kind of religious activity or activity that will be familiar and comfortable and attractive to people who come from the evangelical tradition that would be perhaps would go over the heads of those of us who are not from that tradition. And so I think there may be, on one hand, this seems to be as I say, it's not unlike the sneakers the gold-plated sneakers he was selling a couple of weeks ago. It seems like, oh, another tacky, desperate way to raise money. But I also think there's something going on in his campaign, and this might be a part of that and signaling to some of his supporters, you know, that he's with them. And this is, you know, one of the curiosities of the Trump period is the affection and devotion that some evangelical Christians, not all, but some evangelical Christians have for this guy who appears not on the surface, at least, to be one of them. And you know, that's one of the great riddles of this period. But I think it's interesting. I do think it's worth our attention. What did you, I mean, the late night comics had a great time with
Too
it.
short.
And I think, you know, non-Trump supporters and secular people have been mocking this relentlessly, but I think there is something more there. Sorry.
Yeah, well, so I think he's Trump has a habit of selling things he doesn't actually use, like sneakers or like Trump vodka or Trump wines, and he doesn't drink. You know, his relationship with the Bible is interesting. He, you know, famously when he was president, he talked about 2 Corinthians, which is not how people refer to 2 Corinthians. You know, and there's the in 2020 there was the famous episode where he had security use tear gas to clear Lafayette Park so he could go across the street in front of St. John's Episcopal Church and have his picture taken holding a Bible upside down. It was unclear then whose Bible that was. And so he says in the little video for this Trump Bible that he has many Bibles. It's not clear that he reads many Bibles, but he has many Bibles. This linking, though, in this volume of the Bible with these the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence and country song from, you know, 20 years ago. I think it's fascinating. I think in terms of signaling to, you know, a certain segment of white evangelical voters that he is in favor not only of Christianity but of a kind of Christian nationalism. And I think there is a Christian nationalist movement within the Republican Party that is been there in a variety of forms for many years, but has really become to the fore, I think, especially in the past decade. In interesting and potentially troubling ways, depending on how you think about these things.
Yeah, although I think that's true. Although one of the interesting developments or consequences of that, I think, is there has been, and some of the polling suggests this, a bit of a splintering within evangelical Christians, among white evangelical Christians in particular, some of whom are put off by this, by
Yes.
the and so whilst Trump has some very, very fervent supporters, as I indicated a minute ago, in that community, and some of his strongest supporters come from that tradition, that faith tradition. It has come at a bit of a
Yeah,
cost,
no, I
I
think
think.
that's true, right? Yeah, I think his support among evangelical Christians is fascinating in as much as he doesn't live the life that evangelical Christians, white evangelical Christians, say that people should lead. You know, he's been divorced multiple times, he's had affairs, he doesn't go to church, he didn't go to church on Easter, and hasn't, you know, whereas, you know, Joe Biden goes to church every Sunday, goes to mass regularly, reads the Bible, you know, and what have you. But he doesn't get the he but Trump somehow gets the quote unquote Christian vote, which is fascinating. Right, so let's talk about other presidents though and Bibles. We'll maybe come back to Biden there at the end. Early days. You know, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, those guys. What did they deal with the did they have, was there a George Washington Bible for sale as his inaugural that you could get?
No, but there
That would
were
not
George
include the Bill
Washington.
of Rights because they didn't have that yet.
But there were George Washington sneakers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I would say, and I don't know whether I commend this to our listeners or not, but if you Google presidents in the Bible, which is how I started doing my research for this episode, it takes you to some crazy places on the internet and
Yes.
some really interesting places theologically, politically. And just it's well, do it at your peril. But it's interesting. So Washington, interestingly, the you know, Washington has been claimed by evangelical Christians in the United States. He was, like most of the members of that Virginia gentry, an Anglican. He was a vestryman in his local church. His church attendance seems to have been sporadic, in part because he's a busy guy, and also in part because in 18th century Virginia, church attendance was sporadic. He makes general references to Providence and things like that, especially in the context of some of his political statements or in the context of talking about war. Washington seems to have been a nominal Christian of some stripe, again, an Anglican, as many in the 18th century Virginia were, and had a, he doesn't talk a lot about the Bible. Washington, having now spent a lot of time with Washington in recent years, and his documentary records, he's not very, I mean, he may be introspective, but he's not sharing with either his correspondence or his diary necessarily what he's thinking. And this most personal of beliefs is not something that he left much of a documentary record about. I mean, he owns a Bible, of course, but he
Sure.
and but he's not as engaged with questions around the Bible as Jefferson is. And Jefferson, if we're talking about presidents in the Bible, up until the last week or so, was probably the most famous president when it came to the Bible, because Jefferson's views were somewhat heterodox. He, like Washington, was raised as an Anglican. He supported, of course, he drafted the main law that disestablished the Anglican Church in Virginia, the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. Which was adopted by the House of Delegates in 1786. And so that leads to the separation of church and state in his native Virginia. His views are, as I say, heterodox in the sense that although he's raised an Anglican and attends church services throughout his life, he's very curious, and owns a number of books about religion, including the Quran, and owns a number of Bibles. He's not conventional in his beliefs, certainly, by the standards of that age. He's accused of being an atheist when he runs for president, for example, in the election of 1800. But what talking about the Bible in particular, while he was president, he actually took a razor out and did a kind of cut and paste job on the Bible. Producing a volume that emphasized Jesus's moral teachings. And he produced a small kind of book, because once you take the miracles out of the Bible, and he took
It's
out
pretty
anything
short.
that couldn't be demonstrated by reason, and he produced a volume called The Philosophy of Jesus of Nazareth, which affirmed his conviction that Jesus was not divine. He denied the divinity of Jesus, and he denied the Trinity. And he argued that Jesus was a teacher of common sense, primarily concerned with teaching morals and ethics. Later in his retirement, he expanded on this project, and he really did a job on the New Testaments, looking at, or the New Testament rather, looking at the New Testament in Greek and Latin, of course, but also French, Latin, and English. And he did a kind of pastiche. He cut and pasted. He put the Gospels in an order that he thought would make more sense. So he interspersed accounts from the various Gospels to give it a better narrative flow. And he produced what's known as the Jefferson Bible. He called it The Life and Morals of Jesus. It was an expansion of his earlier effort at this as president. And this is known as the Jefferson Bible. And again, he denied the divinity of Jesus. He did not believe in the Trinity, of course, as a consequence of that. But he extracted from the Bible, from the New Testament, at least, his version of Jesus's life and teachings. He called himself, he said to a friend late in life, that he was a real Christian, that is to say, a disciple of the doctrines of Jesus. Now, most Christians of his day and probably of this day would take issue with that description because he denied the divinity of Jesus. But so Jefferson is probably, Jefferson's activities around the Bible were probably, as I said until last week, the most famous of any presidents. And I would just say, can you imagine?
I was thinking, like, this is not electable in 2024.
No,
guy takes, if a, take, takes a scissors to the Bible and says, here, I made a new version, guys. What do you think?
Exactly. Can you imagine if of either party, a politician were identified as having engaged in this behavior, and he did it while he was president of the United States as a kind of exercise? It's an extraordinary
too
story.
Much free time.
And a few years ago, sorry, David, a few years ago, I was at the Smithsonian, and there were two exhibitions on at the same time, right next to each other. One was, and it was, in fact, developed here at Monticello, on Jefferson and slavery. It was an incredibly powerful exhibition. And next door was an exhibition, and they were showing the Jefferson Bible. And it was by, these things were created in isolation from each other, but it was interesting to have those two things together at the Smithsonian. That was about 10 years ago. They were on. Sorry, you wanted to.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about Jefferson doing that. It does seem like the fact that he was successful as a politician, got reelected despite cutting the Bible up, suggests that maybe the Bible didn't have the same place in sort of the political landscape maybe as it does today. Thinking about symbols of politicians using Bibles, I mean, one of the things that strikes me is George Washington using the Bible in his inauguration, right? Because there's nothing that says you have to do that. Washington did, and he did it on a Masonic Bible, I think. I think the New York Masons still has that copy. And obviously in the 20th century, in the 21st century, we expect presidents and other people to be inaugurated with either the Bible or whatever holy book they tend to favor. But that actually doesn't seem to be the case necessarily for the people who immediately followed Washington to have a Bible at their inauguration.
No, John Quincy Adams used a law book.
Right, which I think is fascinating. And I think there's some other people we don't even know whether they used a book or not when they took the oath. So I think that's fascinating that we have this, attachment now in as part of the ceremony that the Bible is going to be there. And, when Joe Biden got inaugurated, he had his big family Bible that's 5 inches thick and has big sort of metal bindings on it because his family bought it at the end of the 19th century. And there was a lot of weight attached to that. That doesn't seem to be the case in the first half of the 19th century.
No, that's right. And now, again, if one thinks about our current moment, I think if anybody were inaugurated without using a Bible, there would be howls of outrage.
Yes, I think no, that's right. Right.
And John Quincy Adams is interesting. I want to move on to hand things over to you, but he's interesting because he was a Unitarian, which is to say he denied the Trinity. And he grew up in a kind of liberal congregational tradition, like his parents. But he said of the Bible that when duly read and meditated on, it is of all books in the world that which contributes the most to making men good, wise, and happy. And that's a very Adams family kind of expression. They're all about virtue. But despite this, and or perhaps because of this, he didn't choose to be sworn in on a Bible when he became president. He, as I said, he used a law book, perhaps because of his belief that religion and the politics should be kept separate, and that basically, as president, you're taking an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States, not to uphold the Bible. Now, it's interesting, as you said a moment ago, that in the Bibles that former President Trump is selling, the Constitution's included. So there's a fusion there, which I think, again, isn't necessarily widespread, a belief that those things should be united, but there is an element in the United States that does believe that, and he's sending a signal to them. John Quincy Adams would not have agreed with that.
Yeah, I think there's lots of presidents who, in the 19th century at least, who really did believe in the separation of church and state in very profound ways. Jefferson has that famous letter where he writes to the Baptists about the wall of separation or whatever it is he says.
Yeah.
Millard Fillmore, who is usually not part of the major canon of important presidents, but said something very similar. He said, religion and politics should not be mingled. And I think there are many other political leaders of the 19th century who sort of held that view. In terms of 19th century presidents who really maybe broke that mold, Jackson might be one of them. Jackson was raised in a religious household. And if you read his correspondence, he mentions Jesus a lot, or more accurately, he mentions Jesus a lot more than pretty much anybody who came before him. There's lots of references, and as you know, in the sort of first generation of presidents to Providence or the Almighty or some other kind of amorphous conception of divinity. Jackson talks about Jesus and the salvation provided by Jesus and what have you. He read the Bible daily. He became more religious as he got older. But he read the Bible not only privately, but he also read it to his family aloud daily. And sort of near the end of his life, he starts talking about the literal truth of the Bible and seeing the text as being important. And with Jackson's one of the times where you really find the Bible and Christianity coming into the fore in an election, and that's in the elections he has against John Quincy Adams, where Adams reads the Bible, knows the Bible, but has this sort of Unitarian vision of the relationship between church and state, and Jackson is seen much more as a evangelical Christian. And people vote for him in part because of that. They see Adams as being heretical. So Jackson's an interesting figure in that respect.
And of course, the context for that, David, is he becomes president as the Second Great Awakening is taking off. So this
Right,
kind of
exactly.
language is assuming an importance that it hadn't had for the generation before.
To be sure, right. I think that's very important, and the voting masses, the number of people who can vote is much bigger, and so there's a relationship between a democratization of religion, democratization of politics, and Jackson fits right in with all that. A bunch of the guys that will come after Jackson are not particularly religious, and in fact, we know very little about their religious views. Van Buren, William Henry Harrison, John Tyler, Polk, Taylor, like we know almost nothing about their religious world, views beyond maybe what denomination they belong to, and very few of them attended church very regularly. Many of them, like Buchanan, decided not to become a member of a church while he was in Washington because he didn't want to express a preference for one denomination over another. He only joins a church after he leaves the presidency. The tricky one in the 19th century is Lincoln.
Yeah, talk about Lincoln, David.
Okay, so Lincoln's there's a huge debate about Lincoln's religious views and Lincoln's relationship to the Bible. He comes from a religious family. He himself seems to have been well versed in the Bible from an early age. It's one of the few books he had, so he knew the text of the Bible very well. If you read his speeches, he talks. Makes biblical allusions all the time. But he also seems to be something of a skeptic as a young man. He even at one point he's actually running for the state legislature against a minister, and the minister accuses him of being an atheist. And there are biographies that are written of Lincoln. Lots of biographies that are written after his death. And one of the big debates those biographers have is many of which are written by his friends about his religious views. And some of them say, oh, he was a devoutly Christian person. Other people say, no, he really didn't have any strong religious views one way or the other. He never joined a church, he was never baptized. He attended church sporadically. Especially after the death of his son in 1862. But he's clearly somebody who is very, very familiar with the Bible. He show up, the Bible shows up as a reference point throughout his speeches. He makes reference to the Bible in his second inaugural, but he makes reference to it in a very interesting way because he says that, look, both people who fought for the Union and people who fought for the Confederacy read the same Bible. And so instead of saying like the Bible is mine and not my enemies, he's actually saying like actually the Bible belongs to everybody, which is, I guess, sort of the, in some ways, the antithesis of what Trump is doing. Instead of sort of claiming the Bible as being partial to his political philosophy, he's actually saying this is a common link among divisions. His successor, Andrew Johnson, also has a weird relationship with the Bible. He also didn't go to church, wasn't baptized. He did, however, was asked about his religious views, and he says this: "As for my religion, it is the doctrine of the Bible as taught and practiced by Jesus Christ."
Which is kind of what Jefferson says.
But well, yes, I think.
But yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I'm not sure. You know, I think that may be a way of him sort of eliding the fact that he doesn't actually go to church, and you know whether he actually manifests that self or not, hard to say.
What if we can just briefly go back to Lincoln? I one observation I would make is Lincoln was an autodidact, of course. And he read widely and he read well, and he had a real, he was a wonderful writer and speaker. He has a real ear for language. And so he really liked Shakespeare. And I think, you know, the version of the Bible they're reading in the 19th century in the United States is the King James Bible. And I think that with Lincoln's ear for language, the King James Bible is a lot of things. One of the things is it's a beautiful translation. And it's a kind of work of literature that stands on its own. And I think that would have appealed to Lincoln as well. And given it, so I think we see the biblical influence, and you alluded to this, in his use of language, or at least a particular version of the Bible that he's drawing on, that King James Version, which I think again complements the language of Shakespeare
To, I think
as
that's
well.
right. And you know, he's speaking to audiences, some of whom are religious and some of whom are not, but all of whom are familiar with the text. And so these are allusions he can make, and that are familiar ones. But there is a huge debate about Lincoln's religious views, and four or five different denominations have claimed Lincoln, saying, "Oh, he was really secretly a Methodist, or really secretly a Baptist, or really secretly a whatever," and there's very little evidence to support any of those things. He seemed to really like Thomas Paine also as a young man, and Thomas Paine famously was either an atheist or an agnostic, depending on how you want to read Paine, but hostile to organized religion. And Lincoln seemed to have been thinking along those lines at various points in his life.
One thing I should have said about Washington, if this is evidence that we do not script this podcast. So if I
We don't
can
need
get
any more
his,
evidence, Frank. That's
they've got years of evidence to prove this, prove that rather. Lincoln famously wrote in favor of religious toleration, not Lincoln, Washington, in favor of religious toleration in his letter to the Truro Synagogue. And reached out to Jews and saying that, you know, Jews are citizens as well. Also a thing that Jefferson advocated and supported when he advocated the removal of religious tests for naturalization. Although we were mainly talking about the New Testament here, I think that because of their familiarity with the King James Bible, most of these presidents, regardless of their religious belief, would have been well versed in both testaments, in the Old Testament and the New Testament. Sorry, that was a slight U-turn, but it was important to mention, I think.
You know, looking at the presidents that come in the sort of half century after Lincoln, what strikes me is that some of them are very deeply read in the Bible. Some of them are not. So like Grant, for instance, not baptized, not a member of a church, got in trouble at West Point for not wanting to go to chapel. He thought it was un-Republican to make people go to chapel who didn't want to go to chapel. Other presidents, though, like Hayes and Garfield, Benjamin Harrison, you know, were deeply read in the Bible, read the Bible daily, taught Sunday school, some of them led, you know, religious studies of the Bible, but it didn't mix with their politics. One of the things that Garfield said when he Gallican president. He says, I have to step down from the most important job in the world, and that is as a leader of my church to become president of the United States. And so I think this supposition that one's religion should be a private matter and not necessarily part of a political platform, that seems to be sort of the overriding sort of arc of the relationship between presidents and the Bible in the sort of late 19th century.
And I would say down to the middle of the 20th century. I mean,
Century,
it
I think that's
doesn't
right.
really come to the fore again until John Kennedy runs. I mean, we get a when Al Smith runs in 1928 as a Catholic, there really is an anti-Catholic backlash against him. But to a large extent,
Wilson wore his faith on his sleeve in a very profound way.
that's true. That's true. But I still think it's that important a factor in American politics. Except as a negative one, where in the case of Al Smith. And then in 1960, when Kennedy runs, in many respects, it's the culmination of that view that religion should be a private matter. Now, there was an anti-Catholic backlash against Kennedy, and there were concerns that he'd be controlled by the Vatican and all this kind of stuff, which is kind of classic anti-Catholic tropes that, have deep roots in American history. But really, it's not until Jimmy Carter runs, I would argue, in 1976, and Carter came from an explicitly evangelical Christian tradition, but ran as a man of the left, not the far left, but certainly left of center, and was successful. And then what we get in the 1980s is, of course, with the rise of the moral majority and an explicitly conservative version of evangelical Christianity, that the Bible really enters the Bible, and not just the Bible, but also religiosity enters the mainstream of American politics in a way it just hadn't had the same level of prominence prior to that. Is that a fair characterization?
I think it is in terms of, I mean, I think you do have a number of guys who are in the mid 20th century who make reference to the Bible a lot. Truman
Sure.
does a lot, Eisenhower does a lot. But in terms of I don't want to say weaponizing the Bible. Well, I'm not sure why not say weaponizing the Bible. I think that really does come to the fore, in 1980 and subsequently. I mean, one of the things that Reagan does, even though Reagan is probably, undoubtedly a less frequent churchgoer than Jimmy Carter was, because Jimmy Carter was, church was a major part of his life, and Reagan was a irregular
Is
attendee.
David, is Jimmy Carter
Oh,
still alive?
yeah, to be sure. Okay, he's not going to church anymore because he's in hospice. But anyway, yes. But and Reagan, yes. Okay, but Reagan was really cultivating that association with the religious right. He's trying to go for a constitutional amendment to allow prayer in schools. He declares 1983 the year of the Bible, which, I'm not sure even what that means, but he made a presidential proclamation that 1983 was the year of the Bible. The American Civil Liberties Union complained about that, but I think that sort of spoke to a very particular kind of way of using the Bible as a in politics and in public, that was, if not entirely new, pretty different from traditional uses of the Bible in American politics. And I think you see that later on becoming even more to the fore with George W. Bush, who really does sort of identify as an evangelical Christian as being part of his major. Not only his major constituency and a major part of his identity, but part of his sort of mission as president. All right. I think, his faith initiatives that he has his first order as president, I think is a big part of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we see a version of Christianity become heavily politicized in the past 40 years, and we're still living with the consequences of that. And it will be interesting to see whether this is kind of a moment that passes, or and maybe the absurdity of Donald Trump trying to sell Bibles for $60 will be the moment that breaks the fever, or whether this is just the way things will be for the foreseeable future. I would say two things. One, and they're unrelated. Well, maybe they are related. One is, as you know, and many of our listeners will know, American religious life and American Christianity is far more diverse and complex than that represented by this particular brand of politicized Christian nationalism. So I think although this is potent and it plays a powerful role in Republican politics and in American politics more generally at the moment, it's a very broad church to make a pun. And of course, it's not just Christian American religious life. So that bears saying. The other remarkable thing, and I think this speaks to some of the broader changes in American life that kind of go in the other direction, is Biden's Catholicism is not an issue. It's just not. I mean, it comes up in the around the fringes of the abortion debate, but not really. And if you consider this difference in the 64 years since John Kennedy was elected, between Kennedy's election, or the 60 years between Kennedy's election and Biden's election in 2020, the change is remarkable because, the majority of the Supreme Court now are Catholics, and Biden's Catholicism is no longer seen as alien and threatening the way it had been for most of the previous two centuries in American history. And so that I think is a change for the better that's gone largely unremarked. And the fact that it's unremarkable is itself a statement of changes in the culture that seems slightly at odds with the kind of Christian nationalism we're seeing in parts of American life. I'm not sure that
Yeah,
makes
no, I think that
sense
is
as a coherent statement, but
well, I think there are, I think the Catholic Church in the United States is in a very interesting position right now, given its very complicated history over the past 30 years, and the ways in which I think part of the there's I think a split in American Catholicism between those between liberal and conservative Catholics and white Catholics and non-white Catholics and obviously this is sort of rising to the where Biden fits into that is very complicated. But there are actually very few comments about the fact that he was using a Catholic Bible for his inauguration 4 years ago, other than the fact that it was very, very big. That was the jokes that were made about it was that you could probably kill somebody with the Biden Bible because it's from 1893.
I mean, I guess the larger cleavage is now between believers and non-believers in the United States. And so and this would have been unthinkable a century ago. I mean, the one reason the Klan had a second boom in the 1920s was because of the number of Catholics in the country, and Catholic immigrants, and Catholicism and Protestantism were seen as completely antithetical to each other. I think those distinctions have completely blurred and diminished over the subsequent century. And now the fundamental cleavage is between those who believe and those who don't. I think, but
I think it's a
you're
messy. It's
rolling your
it's
eyes. You're rolling
well.
your
I
eyes.
think it's messy because I think there are liberal evangelicals, for instance, who get sort of
Sure.
left out of this debate. There are black evangelicals who sometimes keep white evangelicals at arm's length. The number of Americans right now who don't identify with a religious tradition is is higher now than it has been since the times they've been doing accurate polling about these since the 1950s. And so how they fit into a political worldview where the Republican candidate for president is hawking a Bible and saying this is I don't know how to make sense of all this right now because I think we're at a very I think we're probably at some kind of inflection point about all this, and it's very curious to see how it all unfolds over the next, well, the rest of the election year, if not the next few decades.
Yeah, I mean, I think it will be a generations long trend. We may not see the end of it,
Stay tuned,
or we'll
listeners,
see.
for our next, 4 years from now, when we'll have
All
an update on religion and secularism in American history. Right, time for last drops, Frank. What you got?
Yeah, so I've got a couple of things. One is, I believe that you are giving your inaugural lecture tomorrow, David.
Yes, so people are
Yes.
listening to this on Tuesday. My lecture's on Wednesday, so yes.
It's probably too late for you to attend, but if you're in Edinburgh and hear this before David's lecture, please go, and congratulations,
Oh,
David.
thank you.
It's both an inaugural lecture and a valedictory lecture combined in one, since you'll be leaving us. So
Yes.
it will be unique in the history of inaugural lectures, I think. Do you want to just remind people of the details for
Yeah,
the
so
people local?
50 George Square, room GO3. It's at 5:15. I'll be talking about detectives in the Klan and other kinds of happy, uplifting things. It should be a good time. There's a reception afterwards, so if you're late to the lecture, at least you can get some food.
And the other lecture, there's another upcoming lecture I want to remind people about, which is Professor Shireen Saikali's Fennel Lecture, which will be delivered on May 23rd at 5 o'clock, in the Meadows Lecture Theater. Professor Saikali is speaking. Her lecture is entitled "The Matter of Time: Race, Catastrophe, and Palestine." So it's very timely, and she's coming to us from the University of California at Santa Barbara, and it should be the Fennel Lecture is always a high point of the year. So please come, and you can register online for tickets via Eventbrite. What have you
Sounds
got,
good.
David?
Okay, so I want to recommend there's a book coming out later this week by Kathleen Duvall called Native Nations: A Millennium in North America, which is Kathleen Duvall, I think, as many listeners know. I guess she's your academic sister, technically, isn't that right? In the genealogy, these
We yes, we
kinds of
had the
things.
same PhD advisor.
And she was on my PhD committee, so there's small world. But anyway, she's one of the leading historians of Native American history, and she's got this new book out. But I want to recommend not only the book, which is coming out later this week, but there's an excerpt from the book in the issue of The Atlantic, which came out today, that looks at how Native Americans dealt with climate change. So topical and appropriate. So take a look at both that and order the book, which will be due out later this week.
Yeah, she's a very fine historian. So,
Yes, she is. Great. Till next week, Hank. Cheers.
cheers, David. Good luck with your lecture.
Oh, thanks.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.